Welcome to Security Nation, where each episode we'll chat with security professionals who are taking on big challenges to advance security. You'll learn what worked, what didn't, and hopefully leave feeling a little inspired. I'm your host, Jen Ellis, aka PersecGen on Twitter. I'm super, so excited to be kicking off our first ever guest spot. Before we get into that, let me introduce my co-host for this episode, which is Mr. Todd Beardsley, Director of Research at Rapid7, and general all-around snarky good guy. Todd,
hey,
there we go.
Hey.
Todd and I are also super excited to introduce our very first guest, and a huge thank you to Mr. Zaitberg for being our very first guest and taking this maiden voyage with us. We are delighted and honored. Zait heads up the information security team at Indeed.com. He's worked in technology for more than 20 years, 15 of which have been spent working in info security specifically, including a brief stint at Rapid7 a million years ago, which I'm sure we might touch on later. His relationship with technology goes back even further, though, to his childhood in northwestern Australia, where he lived on a million-acre farm. I don't think I made that up, right? Like, it's a million-acre farm? That's a real thing?
That's a real thing. It's just over a million acres. They call it a station, which is kind of like a ranch, but yeah.
Do they not just call it a city because it's a million freaking acres?
No, because there's only about 15 people in the entire on the entire thing there. So.
Wow. So you went to school via School of the Air over a radio, is that right?
Yeah. So where we lived was so remote. We didn't have electricity and all of that kind of stuff, and they would fly our mail and everything in every couple of weeks. And so there was no school for me to go to. The nearest other human population to us was 125 miles away. So every morning, Monday to Friday, I'd get on the radio for 30 minutes and talk to my classmates who were spread out over a very large geographical area. And then I'd do some kind of homeschooling stuff with my parents. And then the rest of the time, they would just let me roam the outback pretty much.
I'm so completely fascinated by the idea of this unbreaking, and particularly about the idea of like somebody who grew up in an area with no electricity, who has then worked for 20 years in technology. Like, how did you fall in love in technology? How did you get involved with it?
So I think it came from, you know, basically I had a late start. We always lived, you know, in places where we were kind of in the middle of nowhere for a lot of it. And so when, after we lived there, I went straight from living in the middle of nowhere to living in the middle of a big city. And it was kind of the first big city I'd really lived in. And I was like 12 or 13. And I loved technology right from the get-go. And so I kind of made up for it. I dived straight into it and made up for it and immersed myself in it.
Fantastic. What a great, amazing journey. And I think that sort of leads us quite naturally into talking about the specific project that you have been undertaking at Indeed.com.
Sure, sure. So one of the things, the mission at Indeed is, we help people get jobs. That's kind of what we do. And as part of that, we basically aggregate and collect data, and we build software to make that data available and usable to people so that they can help, help them find jobs. So we collect data and build software, and therefore, software engineering, security, or cybersecurity and stuff is a large focus. But we also have a software engineering organization who is, really, really good, and they want to go, like everybody else, they want to go fast. They want to be able to iterate and try new things and deliver value to our customers and be able to pivot and change as fast as possible. And so that leads me into an environment where it's very difficult for me to put any blocks in the way of the engineering team to say, you must pass this gate, to continue going, or you have to get this far and then come and see my team and we'll do a review and that kind of stuff. So
I don't know what you're talking about. Engineering teams love it when they have to be answerable to security teams. It's super popular.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly is.
That's that a great relationship builder.
Yeah, but that leads me to looking for ways to basically kind of build security into their pipeline, into their process. And we have quite a lot of scale to deal with, thousands of sub products inside, the whole website, lots and lots of different pieces of code, thousands of developers doing, you know, hundreds of production deploys a week and all that kind of stuff. It's like, how do I build software assurance? How do I get a good feeling that we're catching as much as we can and reducing the risk as much as we can for that pipeline without slowing it down and putting in kind of arbitrary blocks, and also without, you know, having to run a 500 person security team to manually look at all those things and everything. So that led us to build what we internally call our AppSec pipeline, which is an automated DAST, or, you know, dynamic security tool that integrates with how we build things to basically measure and look at every one of my external facing applications within a 24-hour period, and to take less than 24 hours to automatically detect a new piece of code or a new thing that someone has done and scan it.
Okay, and so where are you in the project? It sounds fascinating.
So we've been working on it, honestly, for about 2 years off and on, and we're at the point now where it's gone from two little pieces of code that work together to 16 pieces of code or applications or APIs that work together. And like I said, we can scan everything that is in our GitLab, even when somebody creates a new thing, within 24 hours. And we're actually at the point now where we're starting to say, okay, how do I take pieces of that and bundle it into smaller pieces that an engineer can run on their laptop while they're building things, or a QA person can attach to the QA thing that they're doing, and will automatically tell them about vulnerabilities. It's also been heavily integrated with our bug bounty, so that I can take a finding from our bug bounty on one piece of software and say, okay, let me look for that same thing across everywhere, and oh, look, I have another 60 instances of it that would not have gotten found with that bug bounty, or that I now potentially don't have to pay out the bug bounty because I know that they're there.
So Zate, this automated DAST scanner thingy, when when you run this thing, like, can you give me an example of the kind of finding that a developer might see? Is this like something that says, you know, oh, hey dog, you just wrote yourself a SQL injection, let's not ship that? Is that like kind of where you're at with it? Or is that the goal?
So that's kind of the goal, is to get that on the developer endpoint. You know, we had right now it sits on the build pipeline. So when people push in code and that kind of stuff, we will pull a copy of it to the side and detect that there's changes, pull a copy at the side and run our dynamic analysis. But it supports, we started off trying to use some off-the-shelf open source tools for this thing. And we had a requirement that it not add more than 15% overhead in terms of time to a build and that kind of stuff. So a lot of the open source products out there were A, not very good at their coverage on understanding how, you know, everything that an application is, and were taking a very long time to go through and do the dynamic part of it. So we wrote a couple of things to build a very, very accurate picture of the application. And also then we wrote basically our own custom vulnerability scanner. And we started off by supporting what are our most common findings in bug crowd. And then we added a few other different pieces. So it does cross-site scripting, open redirects, SQL injection, the whole gamut of the traditional stuff. It doesn't do well at some things that require really good knowledge of the application flow, like IDOR and those kind of things. But we have other little pieces we've built for them. So.
Neat. And I assume you have some kind of, you know, authenticated API checker as well, running at the same time. Cool.
Yeah. So it's made up of a whole bunch of different places. It started off with a thing we call WES, which was it would go and build a dynamic syntax tree, basically, of an application source code. It would go through and crawl all of that and identify methods and URL endpoints and parameters and all that kind of stuff to say, hey, these are all the things on the outside that someone could touch that we should absolutely run a scan on and check. And that also allows, kind of as a side benefit, actually, it builds a very cool way for our developers to come and take a look, or our software engineers to take a look and say, hey, this endpoint with this parameter, and they can click on drilling down to that, and it will actually show them in what code repository, in what line of code that is. So they're actually using that entire product. And we discovered this by accident because we thought it was just for us, but they found it and started using it. And then when we took it down for some maintenance, we get a bunch of, hey, where is that thing? I like that thing. But it allows them to literally go down and see which piece of code is responsible for which endpoint if we get a finding or a bug, even just a QA bug. And it also lets us do, and we don't really do this, but we could even go in and say, like, who checked in that code and that kind of stuff. So it gives us a really good piece there. And then we added to that another little piece we wrote called Nomad that is like our own version of a spider using Selenium and Headless Chrome and a bunch of other things to kind of help build that outside view of the application. And then we combine both of those things into a product we call Ergo that lets us look at those and combine them into one object that then can be fed into through a scheduling app into Ava, which is the vulnerability scanner. So it takes an input of here is everything you need to know about the application, and then Ava just runs through all of those things and does all of our scanning on it. So
that's pretty cool. I mean, it sounds like you've got a pretty great process over there, and indeed of like kind of always raising the low hanging fruit. Like you get the lowest hanging fruit and then you get the next lowest hanging fruit. So you don't have to wait around for your bug bounty to, get a random hit. Like it sounds like you're doing a lot of like real kind of, forward looking, auditing and just like always automating up like the next thing.
Yeah. The bug bounty, and we've been, they've had a bug bounty here since before I joined. It was kind of one of the first major undertakings they took in the whole, software assurance space. And it's transitioned from, it's finding a whole bunch of things and we rely on that to kind of look for stuff to, it's a health checker, sanity checker. It's a, oh, you missed this thing kind of deal. When we find a new thing, out of our bug bounty, we write the check for it and put it into Ava. So we now can literally go through within an hour or two and find that across just about any other code base. And so, we from the necessity of you can't stop people pushing code to production, people can literally create things and go all the way through and push it out to production. We needed to understand when that was happening. We crawl our DNS, we look for new repos. The good thing is that engineering helps us by saying that all new repos, when they're created, have to have some metadata in there that talks about is this an external service, who owns it, and all that kind of stuff. So that we can quick and easily track down which teams own something when we find something and get it in there and get it fixed quickly. So,
yeah, and it sounds like you're bug bountying, right, too, right? Like you're not relying on bug bounty as your primary source because that way leads to madness, where it's more of a safety net, like if you don't happen to see a thing or, they find something novel over there and like, oh, okay, cool. Well, I can re-implement this as like an automated check and I never have to worry about it again.
Yeah. It's just it started off originally as oh my God, but we had, because when I joined Indeed, they had about 8 generalists and I have almost 40 people spread across the entire org now doing.
How long ago did you join?
About 3 years ago.
Okay. So from 8 to about 40 in three years.
A lot of hiring and that kind of stuff. But it's not just AppSec. It's, I'm responsible for security of pretty much, anything cybersecurity at Indeed. So I build out, multiple different teams.
And what does Indeed use to find qualified candidates?
We use all kinds of things. I've actually got some blog posts coming at some stage on how I went about building that team because we did some really interesting, cool things in terms of not only finding candidates but make sure we got the right candidates and that kind of stuff.
So, oh my God, we're totally having you on in the future to talk about that. But back to your AppSec stuff. So it sounds like you've made some pretty amazing progress with it. You happy with where you are? Happy with how things are going?
I think we're happy that we are we've kind of gotten to base camp, you know what I mean? If you're climbing a mountain, I'm happy that we've gotten to a good piece where the work that we've put in, and like I said, this kind of took time over 2 years off and on of a couple of very savvy software developers on my team of building this thing. And the fantastic thing about this is, and I guess this goes into how much of my team operates, is I didn't sit down and say, I want this thing. The team kind of went, well, if we can't you know, get in there and put gates in places and stop stuff, which makes sense. How are we going to solve this problem? And a couple of the members, you know, there's four people involved in this, they kind of sat down and thought about the whole thing, and they built that first little bit, the WES and the AVA, which we call WESAVA, which, you know, we've open sourced out there, the very basic components of that. And they built that first, but then over the next year and a half, they went and added, you know, a way to do authenticated scans, a controller in the middle that schedules things that the developers and software engineers can go and take a look at and know when their application is going to be scanned or was scanned. We built GUI front ends and reporting and integration with Jenkins and a bunch of other things in there. So I feel like that piece is at a good place. But the next phase for us is, how do we take the core of that and keep the speed, but shrink it down and make it A, available to a developer on their own workstation, and B, available to QA. And so the next piece is a thing we call SID proxy, which is taking that AVA engine and saying, I'm going to build a little piece that hooks into how QA runs their checks. So they automate a whole bunch of their QA checks with headless Chrome and Selenium and all that kind of stuff. And we were like, hey, we're kind of doing a little bit of that on our side. What if we wrote some stuff that plugged into how they do their just normal QA checks that are very curated and fully maintained and everything? And those QA checks ran through a proxy that helped us build that view of what the app is. And then we ran it through AVA in parallel and put that as actually part of the build process. And what if the build failed if it found significant AVA findings? Which was kind of that next step for us. And that's where we're literally right at the moment, is testing that out on a few different applications. And it's opt-in right now. It's if an application owner or a product owner wants to opt into this stuff. And what we find is many of them do, because they fully grok that doing this and failing it out in that way and treating these security bugs as just a kind of another form of QA, is leading to less rework and problems, you know, down the road for them. So
you say that they're finding that. Like, I'm imagining though that there's been some level of education or persuasion that's gone on, at least at the beginning of the project, to kind of get people to give it a go to then see the benefit of it. What was that process like for you?
So initially the process was, let's pretend nobody wants this at all ever. How do we build it? And how do we make it work where we don't need anything from them? And so that was the initial piece. But since they've discovered, hey, look, it has a whole UI I can go to and look exactly at all the endpoints. It gives me a view of my application I've never had before. And then they just naturally find, oh, hey, look, I can see the findings from my application. These are interesting. You know, do we have these in our backlog and that kind of stuff? It's been a natural evolution in there. And now we're at the point where we're definitely educating and seeking out people and talking about it and say, hey, we have this thing, you know, let us work with it. It was very important to understand the potential things that are going to make them kind of go, I'm not really like that. That's weird. Or you know, that's going to add too much time to my build times and that kind of stuff. Because if it was taking an hour to build something and we added another hour on top, that's just... It's not going to kind of work. And I think it's easy to say, oh my God, security is important. And it is, but building software is what we do as a company, not building, you know, not securing that kind of stuff. So we want to build that security into the existing process and not hamper it too much. So.
Did you, when you were going through, I mean, you said that you started off by assuming that no one wanted it. Did you, as you were going through sort of ideation and development of the project, did you include representatives of your constituents?
Yeah, there's some teams that we're really close with, and early on, the people building this kind of just work with those teams who were very on board. Like, hey, this
is early adopters.
Yeah, but amazingly, some of those teams are kind of teams internally who do experiments anyhow. Okay. Were very experimental in what they build and that kind of stuff. And they tend to build, for instance, a lot of their stuff on a very standard platform. One of the pieces with this that is harder is that you have to build some of these elements to be reasonably close to what it is you're scanning, and that to get the automation, you need this, the consistency. If your developers are just randomly picking whatever they want off the shelf to build their applications, building something like this is much harder. We were lucky in that we had some, you know, some very standardization in, for instance, the Java frameworks that they're using for these things, or the Python frameworks that they're using. And so we were able to pick, you know, the two or three that just about everybody uses that we've already worked pretty hard to build a lot of security things into, and right. say, we're going to work and make this work with them. Part of the work we have, we want to open source like pretty much all of this eventually. But part of the work we're trying to do now on this is say, how do we make this more modular so that if we do open source it, other people can just write a plugin to say, Wes now supports Golang or Node.js or some other thing. And Ava now supports this other kind of check or in different ways. So we're trying to build it to be more modular for our own use as well, because as software engineering advances and evolves, they pick up new things. For example, we've had to go back and engineer and put a bunch more stuff in there because a lot of our teams are doing far more JavaScript and React flavored things. And initially it didn't support some of that stuff. And we don't want to leave it static because our coverage as we go along and the engineering org evolves, our coverage will shrink until we're only covering the legacy things and not the new things. And so that was important as well.
So it all sounds as if it's gone pretty damn smoothly, but I'm going to guess like nothing ever really goes that smoothly, right? What challenges have you encountered as you've gone through the process?
I think a lot of the really early challenges were around wanting, like it took exceptionally longer than we anticipated. When this was kind of, I said, hey, look, here's this problem. You'll go away and work out how to fix it. And they came back a little bit later and said, hey, we think we want to build this kind of thing. I'm like, okay, well, how long do we think it's going to take? They're like, oh, a quarter, 3 or 4 months, no worries. And I'm like, okay, sweet. It took about 2 years. But the reason was because they were going to use a bunch of off-the-shelf things and just kind of tie them together. And as we kind of got into it and realized like it's not good enough for it to just find vulnerabilities. It has to be modular. It has to detect new things really quickly. It has to be able to run across thousands of potential endpoints within every 24 hours and those kind of things. And so scale was and speed was one of the biggest things to kind of come across to say, how do we build this in such a way that it's going to be very modularized? It's going to run a lot of things in parallel. This whole thing basically exists on a Docker swarm that is pretty much just for this thing with bunches of nodes and stuff. And we're migrating it, as the business does stuff, we'll migrate it into Kubernetes and those kind of places to keep it, right next to where, our software engineers are working. But yeah, scale was kind of probably one of the biggest things. And then we had to do kind of a rewrite of Ava at one stage where it was just taking too long to do certain kind of checks. The other thing that was really apparent is that this is not comprehensive and 100% of all the things. Like when you go out there and you buy an off-the-shelf scanner and that kind of stuff, you're trying to get, say, well, I wanted to cover all the different bits and pieces. There's some low things that we're just like, we're not going to spend time looking for or worrying about that. We'll just let bug bounty people find those kind of particular problems. But, we want to build to solve the harder things. An example of that is we actually got part of the way through and said, I think we need a blind XSS checker for this. So we then went and wrote a bunch of pieces to put a listener out in AWS, and it injects back some JavaScript code that tells us where that thing detonated and all that kind of stuff. That was pretty tricky to get done, and it was a very specific kind of XSS that we felt was very, very dangerous, whereas we didn't put as much effort into just some of the simple reflected XSS. That's actually pretty easy to find in many other ways. So
when you were dealing with things taking longer than you anticipated, given that your team is very busy, you've got a lot to do, you've got day jobs, How did you keep momentum going? How did you keep everybody in it?
So one of the things I've learned at Indeed, and especially plenty of other places, is that if it's not kind of what somebody's focusing on every day, then it's always going to fall to the bottom of the pile. So
I'm guilty of this.
So after we worked out it wasn't going to be done in that quarter and that kind of stuff, I kind of sat down and went, all right, I'm building this team and I'm hiring people to solve all different kind of things. I think I want to keep at least one of these people who seems to be really passionate about this thing, that this is what he's doing right now. And it may take him a year, and I'm prepared to invest a person for that amount of time to do this thing. You know, Indeed is a very, very big on building versus buying for a lot of things. And so it wasn't hard for me to convince people that I'm going to take this resource and dedicate them to do this thing. And then they'll just get help off and on from one or two other people, and people will rotate through and that kind of stuff. But having that one architect on there, or that one person who was really doing that. And that's kind of how we went from having, you know, Wes and Ava, which is kind of the little first iteration, to now I have like 15 or 16 parts of it. It's a big thing, was dedicating a person to it. So
then what was the biggest thing that you learned through the process?
Biggest thing that I learned. I mean, for me as the manager slash leader who didn't write a single piece of code and honestly didn't architect or do any of this kind of stuff, I get to talk about it. It's great. But I didn't build it and that kind of stuff. It was
managers do, right?
Exactly. What would you say you do here? For me, it was that it was really great to see that left alone with a problem and a kind of a core problem to solve, my people just got together and worked it out and solved it in some pretty interesting ways. And now I feel very confident in taking some of the same people who worked on this, or some people from other places, and saying, hey, I want to do that thing there, but like, I want to do that for this other problem over here, or different things like how do we sit down and fundamentally rethink how we've done this thing and build something that, you know, solves this problem at scale for us. So I learned that I can absolutely rely on my people to get stuff done. But we also learned that if you build stuff that helps solve ancillary problems for your engineering team, that might just on the side solve some security problems and get some adoption, that, you know, maybe it's important to spend a little time just helping them solve some of their other problems, and then kind of just sneak in a bit of security stuff in there too. So
I'm having to resist making a Field of Dreams reference here. So if you, I promise this is my last question in interrogating you. If you had to give yourself a piece of advice on thinking about taking on a project like this, what would it be? Or if you were giving other people a piece of advice about this, like, what would your number one piece of advice be?
I think my number one piece of advice in this here is software is magic. You know, we kind of live in this world where you, outside of our reality, you go into, you know, the world of the computers and stuff, you kind of can control a lot of things. You can step down a level when you're running up against kind of the laws of physics inside your program there, you can step down a level and change those things. And we had to do that a little bit here for some of the speed stuff. We had to say, okay, well, we're running into this problem at a higher level. What if we step down a level and rewrote some pieces there? And so understanding that, you know, you can build this big thing, and when you identify your bottlenecks, that as long as you're prepared to kind of dig in a little bit, you can really get down in there and solve those particular bottlenecks, which is what was really key to making this something that our software engineering team would adopt. So understanding like the limitations of the things that they said were kind of out of bounds, or, hey, like this would make it too difficult for me to use this for my project, let us kind of put some really good priorities and borders that were not purely security related, and let us dig down in there. So initially I thought that was not useful when I was talking with the team. I'm like, okay, I get the speed thing, but like, I want it to cover like all the vulnerabilities and that kind of stuff. It's far more effective in where we ended up than where maybe my thought pattern may have taken it. Initially was I was looking for accuracy over speed. And what we got at the end was we cover, you know, 50 to 75% of all the really important things, or we cover all the important things and then, you know, another 25% of mostly important, but we cover it really well and we cover it at speed. That has led to way more adoption in the enterprise than if we had stuck the other way. So I'm glad that I kind of just stepped aside and let my people build a thing and went on and did my job, which is not building this thing. So
I think it's actually incredibly challenging when you hit a roadblock to take a step back and look at it on a different level to how you've been looking at it and to seek new approaches that are not within the same paradigms of the original approaches. So the fact that you guys were doing that and like coming at it at a different level, I think is pretty, pretty amazing. And a good example for others to maybe try and emulate, although it is, as I said, very challenging. I'm not sure how great I am at it. awesome. Well, Todd, did you have anything else that you wanted to jump on before we wrap up?
No, I think it's great. And I really like the analog to software is magic because you get to change the laws of physics when you run into problems. You know, I'm reminded very much of Scotty's approach to engineering on Star Trek. It's like, well, you've got 20 minutes to fix this problem. It's like, well, it's going to take 2 days. Well, okay, I can give you 25, and then you go for it. I agree 100% with Zait. Like when you're dealing with, and it's different, right? Like Zait said early on, it's like, well, I want to build a thing. Zait, I feel like you built a thing. You are living the dream. it is hard. It is hard for security people to like kind of switch over to, you know, making versus breaking. But it sounds like you're doing it, dude.
Yeah, successfully as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think you can use a bit more polish, but I think we're going to, you know, over the course of the rest of the year, try and put more of this out there for other people to get hold of and use. And like I said, Wasava is available on our Indeed Security GitHub right now with some other tools we build. And it's an important part of things that my team builds is like, we should be able to build things that we can put out there for other people to use. And, you know, we have a few other different unique solutions that we've come up with that we're going to put out there.
So. Oh, well, this gives me a perfect opportunity to say, will you come back on when you have open sourced everything? And you can also talk to us about how you go about hiring at the same time.
Yeah, I'm happy to come back and talk about some of those other topics. I have a number of things that I'm kind of write some blog posts on around, you know, managing teams and building teams and looking to deal with burnout in teams and those kind of things that I'm happy to talk about at any time with you all. So.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Zay. We really appreciate it. Thank you for being our first ever guest. And we look forward to speaking to you again. Thanks very much.
I very much appreciate it. And it can only go up from here. So.
What are you saying about it? All right. Take it easy, mate. Bye. Thank you.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Rapid Rundown with me, Todd Beardsley, and my good pal, Matthew Ryder. This week, we'll be hitting three headlines from InfoSecurity that you should be paying attention to. First up, I'm going to talk about Bluekeep, everyone's favorite named vulnerability this week. Bluekeep, a.k.a. The only CVE number I know by heart, CVE 2019-0708. This was a bug in Microsoft Remote Desktop Protocol. It was announced a few weeks ago, so you might be thinking, why are you talking about it this week? This is not news. It's like, well, actually it is. This week, CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is part of U.S. Department of Homeland Security, issued a new advisory on this. And basically, they say a couple things that are kind of new. One, it does in fact affect Windows 2000. And two, they seem to be implying rather strongly that they have a hold of a remote code execution exploit. This is just your weekly reminder now to please use some continuous vulnerability scanning in your enterprise and see what kind of RDP is floating around your network and turn it off if you can, patch it if you can't, and best of luck to you. Moving on, also want to talk about Fresh as of this recording. We have a out-of-band patch for Oracle WebLogic. Oracle WebLogic is built on Java. It's a piece of middleware, usually. Sometimes use it as front end, though. And it is has a little bit of Apache history. No pun intended. When it comes to Java deserialization. So if you're an Oracle shop, you will want to check out CVE 2019-2729. Unlikely to remember that after this podcast. It's a pretty good exploit there, or a pretty good vulnerability. No exploit yet. I would be surprised if an exploit did not surface in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because the thing for me that's scary about that is if you look at the if you dive into the CVSS score, although you don't need to be you need to be on the network, you don't need any privileges. There's no user interaction, and it's a low complexity to exploit. So that's a scary one.
Yeah, Java deserialization bugs tend to be, they're kind of building block exploits at this point. They're pretty well understood by both like attacker, you know, black hat attacker criminal community and penetration testers. So that's why I say like exploit is pretty imminent with this. Finally, rounding out our top three is a story we saw pop up on the Register about some research from Avast, Stanford University, and the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, home of the HAL 9000. Turns out IoT is still awful. Avast, along with these other university researchers, surveyed their customer base with their consent, which is interesting. I'll get to that in a minute, for their home IoT infrastructure, and found a boatload of default passwords, usernames and passwords being used in local consumer IoT. We always know this is a problem. We know that attackers know that this is a problem. This is, you know, the reason why Mirai was a thing. That was a worm from about 3 years ago that ran around and looked for DVRs that were hanging out on the internet with open telnet and a very short password list. The interesting thing to me is that this is one of the few cases where we have a pretty decent sample size of the Avast consumer base that also looked at password auditing. As you know, actually trying usernames and passwords over the internet on other people's stuff is no bueno. That is very illegal in anywhere there are laws. But Avast is able to look at this with the user consent for like a local scan. So that's pretty cool. That's a good bit of research from them. So hat tip. So that's it for this edition of Rapid Rundown. I'm Todd Beardsley.
And I've been Todd Beardsley's British friend who's off to patch his router.
And we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks to the amazing Todd for giving us an update on all the things we should know about security this week. And thank you for tuning in. In the next episode, we're going to have my good friend Lee Brotherston talking about how you build a security program from scratch. Don't miss it.